Okay, good evening, ladies. This evening we're going to be learning Le'iloi Nishmas Dov Berish Ben Meir, Annie's father, whose Shloshim is approaching the Shabbos. That's the first, the Shloshim. A very special, very fine individual. We know the Peros, and we're going to think about him as we continue our learning this evening. Emes Hashem, it should be Le'iloi Nishmasai. We have been doing, just to put ourselves back, and it's been a little while, we had a break of a week, we had a Purim 1 week, and now we're actually back on track to be continuing in Sefer Shmuel. So let's just try to get a sense of where we were and the interesting psychological insights that Tanakh has. When we learn Tanakh, it's important to remember that although we're learning somewhat of a history, it's not just history, it's talking to us right now because humans haven't changed. You know, the history has changed, the surroundings have changed, but we haven't changed. And Tanakh is talking directly to us, and there's a lot that we can learn directly from this. So let's put ourselves back in the place. This is a story in which Yonatan has been extremely gregarious, extremely powerful, and he assassinated a particular Philistine governor or tax collector. And the war is breaking out, and Shaul's men are leaving. Shaul does a korban, is punished for it. And at this critical point where he has, you know, just really a few hundred men left against the tens and tens of thousands of the Philistine soldiers who are better mobilized, better armed. They don't even have regular metal arms, which is separating them between the two sides. And Yonatan just goes for it. He jumps straight into battle, takes him and his arm bearer, and they make the sign, and they say that if the gods are going to beckon to them, they'll attack. If the gods will come and get them, then they won't attack, and they jump into battle. And that's where we last left our heroes. Now, the thing is like this, is that we're going to have to just keep in mind the backdrop of everything we're learning together, just to appreciate the following thought, and that is the role of human initiative in Hashem's plan, meaning how many times are we supposed to take the lead in things? You know, so sometimes you'll have, you know, like the famous story of the individual who's caught in a flood, and he's sitting there and he's waiting and the water starts coming to his doorstep and somebody comes to him and says, quickly, we can get you away. And he says, no worry, Hashem will help me. And it goes on and it gets up to his knees, and somebody's got a paddle boat and says, I'll save you. He says, no. He says, Hashem will save me. Then it gets up to his second floor. He goes up to the second floor and somebody comes and says, I'll save you. He says, no, Hashem's going to save me. And finally, when he's sitting on the steeple of his chimney, and the helicopter comes and he tells them Hashem will save him, and that was the end of that. As they say, there's a famous poem, three old men of Gotham. Oh yes, the end of the story is that he comes and he dies and he goes up to the Shemaim, and Hashem says, why did you die before your time? So the man says, well, Hashem, I was trusted in you to save me. So he says, well, I sent Atzala, I sent the Chaverim, I sent the speedboat, I sent the helicopter, why didn't you? Right, so sometimes, how much initiative do we need to take in that? Do we need to see Hashem's hand or really actually go, you know, to take initiative? But you can put it into more graphic terms of so many decisions we make in life. Are we waiting for Hashem? Are we initiating the action? And over here, this story really pushes the limit of this. Because yeah, you have it's almost an obscenely ridiculous scene if you think about it. I mean, it's so preposterous what's actually going on over here. Here you have this little band, you know, Lahavdil, Robin Hood, his little, you know, his merry men, yeah. Compared to the powerful armies of the Philistines, who are better armed, better equipped. This is going to be like a joke. You know, as this new king in their eyes is arriving, what do you do in this situation? And Yonatan's approach to things is, you take the bull by the horns and you literally charge straight in, because obviously Hashem's with you and Hashem will naturally follow suit, and Hashem does follow suit, and that's how Yonatan approaches things. In fact, Yonatan does this twice. He first assassinates the governor, and then he actually goes to the next step, and he doesn't back away, he doesn't try to, you know, hide his identity, he goes straight into battle first as well. What we're going to have to explore now, as we see this initiative unfolding, is ready to question, is all initiative lauded? Is all initiative good? Is all initiative appropriate? And we're going to see that some initiative is not. So this story itself explores that. As we go a little further, let's keep that in mind as we go through the continuation of the story today. So what we're going to do is the following. We're going to start, we're in the middle of Perek Yudalad. I'd like to sort of carry it through the next 20 or so psukim from Perek Yudalad, Pasuk Yud Zayin, to Pasuk Lamed Hey. That's our goal for tonight. What that'll leave us, in a position to be able to next week deal with blame. Okay, so now we're dealing with initiative tonight, and next week we'll deal with blame. When things don't go right, What do you do? Which direction do you look? And that's the that's the game plan for the next section. So here we are. So what has happened in the meantime is that unbeknownst, you see, we have the advantage of being the omniscient reader, right? Which is wonderful because we get to zoom in and out at any point in time that the narrator decides to lead us. But from Shaul's perspective, he's standing back in his camp without the realization that Yonatan and his brave little arms bearer are busy destroying or entering into the fray in the Philistines. So here now the camera zooms back to home camp in the Giva, and here we have it. So Shaul says to the people, so they notice that something's going on. They see that something's afoot in the Philistine camp, and he says, let's do a count. Now, remember, it isn't so hard to do a count at this point in time, because most of his men have left him, right? So we're not dealing with a very big pot of to draw out of, but they find that in fact missing are Yonatan and his arms bearer. I do want to just note as a very interesting point that the first time that Shaul himself was initiated as a king, what happened was there was this lottery process. Remember we did this a little while back. The quest of the crown, there was this lottery process where it went to Binyamin, to the Mishpacha, to the seat of Yonatan, and it says, I think is the words, that his seat was left empty because Shaul had left to the pantry. Right? The imagery is interesting over here, is and who's missing is the Yonatan over here. Now, Yonatan's not missing because he's trying to evade or avoid the action. He's actually already in the action. Isn't that interesting? If they take a flashback to Shaul's first introduction, so we see something interesting in the contrast of what sort of material the two of them are made of at this point. We go on in Pasuk Ches. Vayomer Shaul Achia, Hagish Aron Alekim, Ki Aron Alekim, Vayomahu Vnei Yisrael. So Shaul turns to the Kohen and he says, "Bring along the Aron. Let's look at the let's ask the Aron." Okay, so apparently the Aaron is going to be coupled with the Urim V'Tumim, okay, because the Aaron itself doesn't project, it's not an oracle in the same way, but the Urim V'Tumim apparently coupled with it would be with the Aaron. And by the way, why is the Aaron here? Just out of interest, why is the Aaron here? Shouldn't it be in the Mishkan? So interestingly enough, at this point in time, there ain't no Mishkan again. Let's just remember this, right? Mishkan is in ruins right now, so the Aaron is more mobile. And you're right, it does come to war. At this point in time, it's clearly in one of the cities. At this point, it seems to be in Giva. And so they're consulting it because, unfortunately, it is mobile, right, at this point in time as well, because of its lack of sanctuary. Vayhi ad diber Shaul el ha-Kohen ve'homon asher b'machane plishtim vayelech holoch v'roiv. And while he's speaking to it, then there's this tumultuous, crowd which is now getting bigger and bigger as he's speaking. He says, "Quickly, take your hand out," meaning I need direction right now. Something's happening, and we're going to lose this moment if you don't give us instructions. So when they arrive, they now run over to the wall, and as they get close, they see that who is killing whom? It is Philistines killing Philistines, right? They're so confused. They don't know where the enemy is coming from. They don't know which direction is up, which direction is down. They're busy killing each other. Because remember at this point in time, the Israeli reconnaissance mission consists of two people who have one sword, right? So and that one sword was one of the two swords that all of Israel had at that point in time, right? So what's happening is a complete pandemonium, and they're decimating each other. Now v'ha'ivrim hayu la'plishtim ke'esmol shilsham, and apparently we have these Ivrim. Let's not translate for a moment. We have these Ivrim who used to be with the Philistines, Asher alu imayim b'machane sovei, who used to be amongst the camp, v'gam heim aliyos im Yisrael, Asher im Shaul v'riyonos. And suddenly, they are now no longer with the Philistines, they're with the army of Shaul and Yonatan. Because we have to work out who these Ivrim are. And let's get to the end of this section, after Apostle Kov Dalet. We'll call Ish Yisrael mi'amischa be'im b'har Ephraim, shamu kinosu plishtim, v'yidbuku gam heim achareim b'milchama, and all the Jews who are hiding in, all the people of Israel who are hiding in the caves. Now, emerged. Remember as Shaul's army was quickly dissipating when they heard about the Philistines, so they all went and found their cozy caves. Now they all are like ants coming out because they hear about the prey. And Hashem saved on that day Israel, and the war passed this area called Beis Aven. Now, let's just consider this from a few perspectives. We see like this is a remarkable description over here. Meaning, ultimately, the victory was not in the hands of Israel, but in the hands of the Philistines themselves. It was completely miraculous. This was friendly fire. What was going on over here? So let's try to appreciate this for a second. So one thing that's important to realize is let's take a quick focus on Shaul HaMelech himself. What does Shaul do when he's in a pinch? So we've seen what he does in a pinch beforehand. Let's remember. Beforehand, what was the earliest pinch that Shaul had in this particular episode? Well, let's take ourselves back.
He had to wait for Shmuel.
Okay, so remember what happens is there's a 7-day window. He has to wait for Shmuel HaNavi. In the meantime, the Philistines are really amassing troops on the western side. His men are dissipating. They're leaving. All the excuses in the world. I forgot the babysitter, whatever it was, and they're all disappearing right now in front of his own eyes. And he has to make a decision. So what does Shaul do in a pinch? What did he do there? He took the initiative. He brought the korban. He felt that he couldn't wait for Shmuel. He thought it was in the best interest of the people to bring the korban to elicit, essentially, Ruach HaKodesh. And at the moment he shechted the korban, that's when Shmuel emerged. Okay, so now it's interesting because on the one hand, that was an act of initiative. On the other hand, it was also an act of dependence, if you think about it. Why did he need the korban? Meaning, why was the korban so essential to the battle? He needed God's spirit. He needed God's guidance to be able to win this battle. So he was dependent, and therefore he took the initiative to connect the circuits before Shmuel was there to connect the circuits for him. That was what he was trying to do. Now we have a second time that he's in a pinch. This time he doesn't know what's going on. He sees there's a hubbub going on out there, and he doesn't know if it's good, if it's bad. I mean, it could be bad. It could be also that they're coming towards him. It could be that they're being hurt by somebody. He doesn't know. He knows that Yonatan's missing. Not 100% sure of what's going on. So in a pinch of it, what's his first thing he does? Again, a move of, this is also an act of somewhat dependence, right? Meaning, what's he doing? He needs God's advice. But now, remember, last time, he didn't consult in the Urim V'Tumim. Isn't that interesting? Last time, he didn't consult with the Urim V'Tumim. Now, is that because he learned his lesson? Maybe he should have consulted the Urim V'Tumim then? Not sure. Maybe it wasn't accessible to him yet, because they were in a different place? We're not sure, but at this point in time, you just see a different mode of operation, and he actually seems to leave that to jump straight into battle because he knows he needs to take the initiative over here. So again, there's this balance of dependence and initiative which Shaul is displaying to us. and the way the Radak puts it is most beautifully. Just take a quick look at the first line in the Radak in source 1. In the source sections, this is page 5 of our... each consecutive section is going to be on the continuing pages. So it's on page 5 in the sources, which says part 3 on the top, Shaul's battle. Says the Radak says the following: V'kasher ra'a Shaul ki ha'mona shebamachane plishtim holeich umismogeg. So as he sees, there's this terrible tumult in the Philistine camp. Amar la'kohen esof yodcha ki ein panai atosh shelo laleches lemilchama. He says, "Return your hand. You can't now search the Urim V'Tumim." Okay, because there's no time. Ki ra'im anachnu ki elokim imonu. God must be with us. Meaning, I don't need to look to God's oracles. I know from God's interaction with this world, and he says, so what happens is, it's interesting. Shaul HaMelech now, this is almost like an advance. Shaul now has seen God, not in the Urim V'Tumim, but where has he seen him? In the action. Okay, so if you think about it, that was more of Yonatan's perspective. Yonatan wasn't consulting with anybody. Yonatan had a very distinct and very clear and confident view that Hashem was with him. And he says, we're going in, and if the Philistine God responds in a certain way, we know God's with us, and that's it, boom. Right? So that he sees God in the world that he's acting. Shaul first turns to the oracle, and then he wants to see Hashem speak to him, and then he realizes Hashem is speaking to him through the battle itself, and he pivots straight into the battle through that. That's a transformative moment over here. You see, because this is important to us, because in our lives, generally speaking, I don't know about anybody else, we don't generally have notes under our pillows in the morning. I mean, the instruction manual for the next day would be very convenient. But we don't. We simply don't. There's lots of confusion in life. And we actually have to be able to make the same move, where as opposed to looking all the time for somebody to actually, this great baritone voice to emit from the clouds of the music, without that moment in life, sometimes we have to look to the action and realize that Hashem actually is speaking to us. at this point in time. That's what the Shaul's realization that the Radak is saying. I remember that once there was a few years ago, so when my little Moshe was 3 years old. So he, I was out, and he was eating cantaloupe at the time. I'm sure I mentioned the story. And he was eating cantaloupe, and at this point in time, he was, you know, he stopped in the middle, and he said, "Thank you, Hashem, for the beautiful cantaloupe," which is wonderful, you know, just out of his own initiative. We talked about how brachos do this and so on, but he just spontaneously thanked Hashem. That was wonderful. And then, after a brief silence, he said, "Imma, why does Hashem not answer me?" So before she could answer, he answered his question. He says, "It's probably because he's not listening," because he knew that when people don't answer him, not parents, of course, but when people may be reading a newspaper and not answering him, it's because they're not listening, right? Which is a logical application of the same process, right? So my wife said, "No, he really is listening." So, and the question, of course, all then is, why doesn't he answer? Now, of course, you have to explain this in 3-year-old terms. So what's the obvious answer to this question is ask your father. So I get this phone call on my way in the car, and here I have to answer this, you know, philosophy 703 at three-year-old level. So I consulted with a few of my teachers, and one of the things they said was a very interesting point, and that is that Hashem is always listening to us, but he doesn't answer in a loud voice. The way he answers us is by showing us that he's listening, by giving us more cantaloupe, and by giving us the things we like in life. And that's the way Hashem speaks to us, is by acting with us rather than speaking to us. And I think that's like a little bit what the Radak is saying over here, is that Shaul was trying to find that answer, but he didn't realize the answer's right there. And that's perhaps where Yonatan was already. That's why Yonatan was in the battle already, because he wasn't waiting for God to tell him. He knew what was going on. It's just a very interesting balance over here. A very interesting balance that's going on. Anyway, so this is Shaul's realization. And now we come back to battle. So who are these Ivrim? The word Aver literally means, just to come back to this, Aver literally means aside. And usually Ivrim you are used to describe Jews, right? Because Avram was the first person called Avram HaIvri. And the denotation was that Avram Avinu was, we'll call it, countercultural. Now the question we really have is, who are these Ivrim? So as they're charging into battle, suddenly these Ivrim join as part of the battle. Who are they? Who are these people that are joining them? So it's described in the passage that they were to the Plishtim. Hayuk la Plishtim ke'asmal shilshon. Happens to be, if you read carefully, it looks like there may be a debate between the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, and the Malbim as to who these people who suddenly join into the battle are. Take a look in the sources, and again, take a look in source 2. The Radak says the following. Why Ivrim? Who are these Ivrim? Pirush oysan ha'Ivrim asher hayu le Plishtim ke'asmal shilshon asher yugarim ba'artzom asher onu imam va'al korcham li'lochem b'Yisrael. So, it sounds like these are people who lived in the midst of the Philistines, and they had to fight Israel when the Philistines willed them to. V'yubamachine saviv, and they were encamped around the Philistine territories. Kelomar shelohayu sham midatam v'lohayu shtsamim atzom v'machine ela misaviv michutz kedei limshach yedayim v'liyosam nishmotim v'lilochem b'Yisrael. Up till now, they kind of wanted to be the neutral folks. They didn't want to get involved. And as much as possible. Sometimes they'd be forced by the Plishtim to fight on their side. And now what they see, there's the success of Israel. They join onto Israel's war effort. You know, the kind of, you know, semi-neutral forces in the world, sometimes fighting on one side, sometimes fighting on the other side. Not as bad as mercenaries, but nonetheless, people who have who don't really have necessarily their own identity, who don't have necessarily their own passion or nationalism. So this is who they are, says the Radak. Not clearly indicated that they're actually Jewish in the Radak, or Israelite. Whereas, if you drop down to the Malbim in the next source, the Malbim says, pretty explicitly, Ha'Ivrim, She'Yisrael, She'Goru, B'Tzad, Marav Eretz Yisrael, Ba'are Plishtim, Hayu Leplishtim, Keres Mosh Shoshom, Nichnaim Tachtam. The Malbim says these were in fact Israelites themselves, and these Israelites lived among the Plishtim, but they were subdued, they had to pay taxes, they were under their thumb, and they waited in wait until this moment when they saw the battle was fighting on the side of Israel, they joined in there what they were waiting to the whole time. Either way, over here, it's fascinating if you can imagine the picture of the battle over here. It's obviously an expanding battle. You have it starting off, we're talking about Shaul's small forces, and then all the people of the hills of Judea join part of it, and now even the people who are embedded in the Philistine territory. This is, you know, pretty common when it comes to war, about the people who are almost like, you know, sleeper cells waiting for their
the war on the other side to join them, and then suddenly they're activated. This is what seems to be described over here in this next section. Now, as we consider this section, we need to really ask ourselves a very fundamental and basic question. And that question is, Shaul made a very, very strong statement over here. He made this requirement that nobody eat anything today. So we have to ask a number of questions about that. Number one is, and let's go with them in sequence, can a person halachically, legally construct such a curse in the first place? Is that a possibility? Number two, what was his intention in creating that? And Bezos Hashem, next week we'll discuss, was he justified in making that? Okay, so three separate questions. Let's start off with the first one. Can a person make such a curse? Happens to be the Torah mandates that the words of our mouths can, in fact, form legal statements which are binding. So example being, the beginning of Parashas Matos, in Bamidbar Perek Lamed, it says, this is in source 4, Ish ki yidor neder la Hashem, a person who takes upon themselves a neder is where they say a particular object is bound to them, is not allowed to them, like a korban, or yishavah shvua, or they make a requirement on their action, I'm going to jump up and down on Tuesdays. Or to prevent something which they can't access anymore. Lo yachel dvar, do not make your words empty. Kachol ayat semipiyase, a person has to follow the words of their mouths, which means to say, you have almost created your own mitzvah. The Torah has given you, has enfranchised you to use your mouth to create a new type of mitzvah. Now we have to ask ourselves, well, that's all very nice and good, but that refers to any requirements or any legal, we'll call it, parameters that you create for whom? For yourself. You have the right to be able to mandate what you will do, what you will or will not eat, what you will or will not engage in. But can you make a statement, a legal statement which governs others? Can I say that for 3 weeks' time you're not going to eat chocolate pie? Does that make sense? That isn't under the rubric of what a neder is. So where is Shaul getting his mandate from? How is he able to mandate what other people should be doing? So it happens to be, if we look very carefully, at the end of the Sefer Vayikra, after all the curses are done and through, there's a very interesting description of where a person can actually take their words to dedicate items that they own to the Beis HaMikdash. And in and amongst that, that's called Erchin, very interesting section in the Torah. In and amongst that, embedded in that, is a statement which is a little perplexing. Here is in Source 5. The Torah tells us, Kol Chayrem Asher Yocharam, Mina Adam Lo Yipodeh. Any devoted object, a person makes an object devoted, can lo yipodeh, can never be redeemed moisu mos, but keshal should be put to death. Which means on the basic level, if a person takes an animal and dedicates it, it cannot be extracted if it's dedicated in a certain way. However, the Ramban, Nachmanides, on this particular pasuk, goes to extreme lengths and uses this pasuk as a wedge to understand many areas in Tanakh. He tells us the following. He quotes this is the very top of this of the next page, which is labeled page 6. V'od matzasi ba'agari yalamdeinu. I found in a midrash yalamdeinu. There are many different types of midrash. There's a midrash Rava, Tanchuma, Yaakov Shimoni, Yaakov Ruveni, Yaakov Mechiri. This is one called midrash yalamdeinu. Agari yalamdeinu. So he quotes this less common midrash, and he says, Tanya, Rabbi Akiva Oimer, Hacherem hu hashavua ba'ashua hu hacherem. A cherem, this halachic terminology that the pasuk is describing, is a type of shvuah, a call or a legal articulated term which mandates action. And she yovesh gil yovesh avru al acherem v'nischayv u'misa. And an example is that as we saw at the end of Sefer Shoftim, when all of Israel went to war against Binyamin, they made a cherem that everybody should go out to attack Binyamin, and one city did not partake, the men of Anshe Yovesh Gilad, which means they were culpable for that and whoever were put to death. So he says, you see over here that there's a notion of a communal requirement on everybody. So here's how he explains it. He says, "Vakach ani omer," says the Ramban, I explain the following. Ki min hakosuv hazeh yotza lohem adin hazeh. This pasuk talking about the cherem, this notion of a cherem, is where the tribes understood this from. Shekol melech bi Yisrael, or Sanhedre gedola, b'mamad kol Yisrael. Any king over all of Israel, any Sanhedrin, court of the highest, the supreme court of justice in the state of Israel, who decides in the presence as representative of all of Israel, that there's a particular war that needs to be fought. Yesh lehem reshus b'mishpatim. Im yachrimu al ir lilachem aleha, that they want to destroy a city. Also the word cherem is to destroy. So they're saying there's a destruction edict on a particular or war to be waged. V'chein im yachrimu al davar, ha'over alav chayev misa. If they say that there's a particular city which needs to be destroyed, and they make that a cherem, then everybody who disagrees with that is therefore liable for death. Kabbalah for Misa. That's the way he reads the pasuk. We're going to see this is going to be the downfall, or perhaps the danger which Yonatan is going to experience in just a moment. So just appreciate how he reads this in the pasuk. He said, "Kol cherem asher yocharam min ha'adam lo yipadeh." He understands the way the pasuk is to be read in this reading, based on the Midrash, is that if all of Israel, as one unit, decides to make a cherem of one institute, of one city, then it cannot be redeemed. And anybody who, in fact, diverges from that mandate is going to be put to death. So says the Ramban, and this is basically the foundation for Shaul's statement over here. He believes at this point in time, as a king, as representative of all of Israel, that should they not continue the battle, there's going to be problems. He's decided that they need to finish this battle till the end to kill the fleeing Philistine soldiers. And because he makes a cherem, anybody who's outside of that cherem, anybody who's outside of that edict, who's not going to continue with that, in this case it means by even eating, is going to be liable for death. So Shaul does have the justification for making this. But more importantly than the justification at this point in time, is in this case, why? Meaning, why was it so important for Shaul to make this important statement here and now? What was so important about not eating yet and running into battle at this point in time? Not so clear. The Radak, again, we're going back to the Radak. The Radak and the Malbim are going to really be the centerpieces of our shir today. The Radak describes this in the following. He says, let's take a look over here in the source 7. He says, Kilomar, in the middle of the first line, this means to say, Shoyu Re'evim, Ki Kvari Shbiya Shol Esa'am Shlo Yochal Ara Erev Kadei Shlo Yafsikum HaMilchama. Shaul thought that the Radak makes it he sort of takes the point to an extra level. It was to press them to continue with the war. Meaning to say that he understood that he wanted them not to eat because he wanted them to carry on this battle. The battle couldn't be dropped. Now, why? Why was it so important to him? The Malbim opens up a little deeper for us. The Malbim says really two remarkable points. He says, he notes first of all that the first part of this battle is clearly supernatural, meaning to say, or at least guided by the supernatural, because you know we're talking about Yonatan and his arms bearer starting a battle against an army, innumerable army, and now they're in pursuit. He says clearly, Hashem had his hand deep in this pie. He was very involved in this battle over here. He said, but the Malbim says, if you look at the pesukim very carefully, that may actually have ended, meaning to say, once the battle finished over here, there was a turning point. Let's take a quick look at the way he reads this. The Malbim says, let's take a look at source 8. He says, V'ish Yisrael Nigash. Rotze lomar. Sha'ul ra'a b'voya le'beis oven. Sha'am hifsiku min ha'melchama. He sees, when he reaches the area of Beis Oven, that people have stopped fighting. K'mo shekasuv ha'melchama avra. The passage describes that the war had in fact finished. What does it mean the war had finished? He says, V'chol mirdov acharei tzareihem. He understood that when the passage describes the war had passed, up till now had been fighting, now is fleeing. That means to say that the hashkocha aspect of this war, the supernatural involvement, has ended now, the war is finished in the eyes of the soldiers. And the reason why is because they didn't really even want to be fighting this battle in the first place. They weren't fighting this battle because of freedom, civil rights, nationalism. They were fighting it because Shaul wanted them. Shaul forced them into this battle. Yonatan committed a homicide against a Philistine tax collector. They need to fight the battle, and that's why they're fighting. Therefore, the moment they found a moment where, okay, the enemies are running away, that's it, we did our job, let's sit down, let's have lunch. Okay? Lokach vayoyel sha'ol yishpion be'ala bal yoychu lechem l'mal yakum yikom goy vayvav.
So the Rambam says that Shaul now had to double down and say, no, folks, the war ain't over. Even though the fighting is over, we need to drive a final nail into this coffin. We need to make sure they're never going to take over us again, all these nations. And he pushes in further.
Remember that, as is discussed between the Masan and the Mefarshim over here, they point out that actually on the day of battle, people would never eat in the first place. They would always fast because fasting was a way of coming close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a form of tefillah. And certainly in those days, more than today. Today we're much weaker. And even some of the smaller fasts like Beis, people are recommended not to. Not the regulars, don't worry. The minor and major fasts are fully in effect. But smaller fasts, like what's called Bahab, are less people do today. In those days, fasting would be a way to find strength, to find connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that would be the way they would win the battle. So they were fasting up to this point in the day, and Shaul says, the battle ain't over, carry on fasting. You may not have wanted to be part of this, but we need to take the full restitution against this nation. And that's why Shaul pushed them this extra mile over here.
So this is what's going on over here. Now, we're going to have to answer the question next week, which is, was he correct? Was he justified? Was this the right approach to be taking under such circumstances to push them this far? We'll see that in session next week. But before we get to our response or Tanakh's response, let's see somebody else who responded to this. So you have a very fascinating scene that unfolds, a very unusual scene which unfolds. Let's take a look at the Pesukim. We're going to read the next few Pesukim, moving from Chav Hei to Lamed. Okay, so the next six Pesukim. The people are running after the Philistines. They're running westward and into the coastal plain. They enter into this unusual forest. What happens is that as they enter into the forest, they realize there's honey dripping off the trees. There's a debate in the forest. Are we talking about cane sugar? Are we talking about bee honey? There's a whole debate as to what this really is. But nonetheless, they're entering into a forest where they have access to food, you know, very sweet food. And people are terrified. They don't want to eat anything because of the shvur that Shaul HaMelech has placed upon them. What happened was that Yonatan was also going through the same forest. Ostensibly, he must have been ahead of the troops at this point in time. He takes his staff, he dips it in the honey on the ground or the tree, and he now puts it in his mouth, and his eyes are lit up. Then he is vato'orno enov. His eyes are lit up because obviously he was famished, and this gave him an extra amount of strength. By the way, just this is fascinating as a side note, there is a book called Yaros Tuvash, which is a book written by Rav Yonasan Ivershitz, a great of a few hundred years ago. And in the 1700s, and Rav Yonasan Ivershitz wrote one of his svarim, the name was Yaros Tuvash from this pasuk, and of course his name was Yonasan, which relates to this. It's just a very fascinating side point over here. Whenever you come across that sefer in the next time you come, this is where we learn it from. Everything is the Tanakh, of course. We continue. Vayana ishvei am vayomer hashvei ishvei avicha esa am leimor arura ishe sheyochal lechem hayom vayofam. And they said, look, your father made this shua. Obviously, he didn't hear. He wasn't there when this was happening. He was already in battle. And he says, we're all tired. But now look what's going to happen. You just broke the shua. Look what you did. What a statement. Yonatan says, my father blocked up the land. Look at my eyes. I have so much more vigor from having tasted this honey. It gives me the strength to go on. My father blocked up the land. A critique of his own father. Very, very powerful statement. If we'd eaten lunch, if we'd taken from their supplies, would we not have had even a stronger response to the Philistines? So Yonatan is saying, maybe the ends that Shaul wanted to arrive at, which is complete destruction of the Philistines, would have been arrived at better, more formidably, if they'd actually eaten, as Yonatan suggests. Take a look at the Ralbag at the very end over here, and this is where we're going to stop. The Ralbag says, V'choshav, she'im ochal ha'om mishlal oivav hoyu mischazkim yoser, v'atire ev'atayrev mipnei ze ha'maka pelishtim.
Shaul's logic, says the Ralbag, Rav Levi Ben Gershon, is very simple. He says, look, this is all a supernatural pursuit. It is clearly not something that happens every day, that two men wage a war against an army of such magnitude and cause it to run to refuge. It clearly, it's the hand of Hashem. And if it's the hand of Hashem, you don't need to go to basic physical requirements to get people to continue in the war effort. Shaul, you're treating this war as if it is natural, when it isn't natural. Don't think naturally or militarily. Think about Hashem, what Hashem wants, not necessarily the military aspect as well. And that's what Yonatan was perhaps criticizing his father. It's interesting that he does not make this critique in front of his father, and we're going to see and explore next week what's going to happen over here. Is Yonatan going to be liable? Is this war going to be successful? Was Shaul justified? Where's the blame going to be laid? Metz Hashem, that's going to be laid ahead for us next week. Looking forward to continuing.